Donc, monsieur le consul des États-Unis, monsieur Peter Agré, chers collègues, chers étudiants, mesdames et messieurs, tout d'abord, le président de l'université, Manuel Thunon de Lara, s'excuse de ne pas être présent là pour cette conférence. Comme certains d'entre vous le savent, il a été retenu par une réunion à Paris de la conférence des présidents d'université. En ce moment, il est dans l'avion et donc il se joindra à nous pour la cérémonie de remise du doctorat honoris causa après cette conférence. The University Victor Ségalen Bordeaux II is greatly honored and proud to host the conference of Professor Peter Agré, a scientist who was not only awarded a Nobel Prize, but who is also internationally recognized for his wise political activisms. As Peter Agré's conference is going to be given in English, I thought that I would give a short introduction in French. Maybe this introduction could be of help, at least for some of us, to understand everything in the conference. Alors, Peter Agré est d'origine norvégienne et suédoise. Il est né aux États-Unis. Il a fait des études de médecine à l'université Johns Hopkins à Baltimore, aux États-Unis. Et ensuite, il a assumé plusieurs fonctions en faisant donc de la recherche, bien sûr, avant de devenir professeur de biologie cellulaire en 1993 dans cette même université, dont Johns Hopkins. Et récemment, donc, il a accepté la direction du Johns Hopkins Malaria Research Center, Research Institute, pardon. Il occupe également des fonctions d'enseignant dans l'université de Duke, également à Baltimore. Alors, il a réalisé des travaux de recherche, en particulier en hématologie, et ce qui l'a conduit... Alors, il dit en fait par chance, mais enfin, on verra que ce n'était pas vraiment tout à fait ça, a identifié une protéine membranaire très abondante au niveau du globule rouge. Et en utilisant donc un système particulièrement ingénieux d'expression de cette protéine dans les ovocytes de Xénope, cela lui a permis de démontrer que cette protéine était un canal à eau qui était recherché d'ailleurs depuis des décennies par les physiologistes. Et ce canal à eau, vous le savez, a été nommé aquaporine. Alors, pour ceux d'entre vous, bon, il y a beaucoup de biologistes ici, mais pour ceux d'entre vous qui se demandent ce que c'est que le xénope, je rappelle en fait que c'est une espèce de batracien qui est très utilisé dans les laboratoires de biologie pour étudier notamment le développement embryonnaire, le cycle cellulaire, mais aussi des mécanismes de réparation de l'ADN. D'ailleurs, c'est un modèle qui est utilisé dans cette université notamment pour étudier le développement aussi. À la suite de cette découverte qui est tout à fait essentielle en biologie, Peter Agré et son équipe, mais aussi en fait à travers de très nombreuses collaborations, c'est ça qui est assez remarquable aussi, des collaborations d'ailleurs avec certains groupes en France, Peter Agré en fait a identifié plusieurs familles d'aquaporines chez les bactéries, chez les plantes, et puis chez différents animaux, les insectes, les mammifères. Ce qu'il faut bien comprendre aussi, ce qui au départ, bien sûr, était pouvait sembler comme une découverte purement de biologie fondamentale, a conduit, et c'est pratiquement toujours le cas d'ailleurs, à des stratégies qui visent à corriger le mauvais fonctionnement de ces canaux dans différentes pathologies, des pathologies rénales, des pathologies musculaires ou affectant encore d'autres organes. Alors, la qualité des travaux de Peter Agré dans l'identification de ces aquaporines lui a valu donc avec Roderick MacKinnon d'avoir en fait le prix Nobel de chimie en 2003 pour donc l'ensemble des travaux sur les canaux dans les membranes biologiques. Alors ça, c'est seulement, finalement, on pourrait dire, en simplifiant, une partie du personnage, parce que l'autre partie du personnage est marquée par un engagement très, très important dans la vie publique. Ce n'est pas seulement un scientifique dans son laboratoire, c'est aussi quelqu'un qui est très engagé. Alors, il y a plusieurs facettes de cet engagement que j'ai pu trouver. Un engagement, par exemple, dans la lutte à l'accès aux résultats scientifiques en accès libre, ce qu'on appelle l'open access, et puis un grand nombre d'engagements aussi, en fait, dans le domaine de la défense des droits de l'homme. À ce titre, et en tant que microbiologiste, je tiens à saluer d'ailleurs son engagement lorsqu'il a pris la défense de Thomas Butler, un microbiologiste spécialiste de la peste, qui travaillait au Texas et qui a été poursuivi donc par le FBI pour avoir, alors c'est assez bizarre, pour avoir volontairement déclaré avoir perdu la trace de quelques échantillons dans son laboratoire. On pense que les échantillons ont été détruits par une inadvertance et l'honnêteté de ce scientifique lui a valu en fait d'être emprisonné d'ailleurs. Et plusieurs scientifiques se sont émus et ont manifesté contre cette condamnation, et Peter Agrey était dans les premiers à manifester en fait contre cette condamnation. Dans son engagement, en fait, on le retrouve aussi dans son opposition, à certains moments de l'administration du président Bush, et notamment en ce qui concerne la position qui avait été prise par cette administration lors du protocole de Kyoto. Et plus récemment, donc, il s'est engagé donc, auprès de Barack Obama lors de l'élection présidentielle américaine donc en 2008. Et je pense que l'ensemble de son action, son engagement traduit donc une volonté forte, enfin, il va nous en parler j'imagine, de promouvoir la recherche scientifique au niveau de la question publique et de mettre ces questions scientifiques, non pas seulement donc au niveau des laboratoires, mais de porter en fait ces questions scientifiques au cœur du débat politique. Alors, l'attribution à Peter Agrey du titre de docteur honoris causa qu'on va décerner après cette conférence, on représente pour l'université en fait une opportunité unique de créer des liens entre notre université bien sûr et le groupe et l'université dont provient donc Peter Agrey, à travers bien sûr des échanges d'étudiants ou de chercheurs ou des collaborations scientifiques.
Well, good afternoon. I'm very sorry. I'm not fluent in French, so I won't even try to speak to you in French. But it's a great honor to be here in Bordeaux amongst friends and colleagues and to make new friendships. And I'm honored and humbled to have the opportunity to talk to you about a life in science today. I thought this might be of some greater general interest than the technical lecture on the aquaporins. And I think there's some messages I would like to convey. First off, being a scientist is not punishment. This is a fun, enjoyable career. Secondly, science is about young people. All scientists became scientists when they were young, and we rely upon young people to do the science. The young people that have come to our laboratory from all around the world have made it work. Thirdly, it's about friendships, collaborations. Scientists in other countries work together. It's a language shared despite political differences and geographic differences. And finally, I think it's important to remember to do something useful in science. The well-known American actor Paul Newman, in addition to being an actor, used his prominence to found a company making salad dressing and foods, of which the profits all went to charity. And he wrote a book about this, and the title is, I think, poignant, Shameless Exploitation in Pursuit of the Common Good. And I think science really is in pursuit of the common good. Now, lest you fear that a Nobel laureate as an excessively knowledgeable and serious person, I'll give you a secret story about how you can win the Nobel Prize. And this story is not unique to me. This is a story I've first heard from Michael Brown at the University of Texas, and I think it puts it in perspective. So it's true most laureates are men, although Professor Sinusi at Institut Pasteur is not a man. She has a Nobel. So most laureates are men, they're older, and they tend to be rather formal. But this story kind of sets it straight. So the story starts in a Nobel laureate and his wife on vacation in one of the national parks in California in the desert, maybe it's Joshua Tree National Park, and the laureate is driving the car, and his wife is sitting very demurely beside him in the front seat, and they're running low on petrol. So they leave the park, and at a highway convenience store, the Nobel laureate stops to fill up the tank at the self-service. So he's standing by the gasoline tank, filling the tank, and his wife is sitting in the front seat of the car, and she sees through the windshield at the convenience store an elderly hippie leaving the store, and she recognizes this man. She knows him. She gets out of the car, and she runs across the parking lot and throws her arms around the old hippie, and he recognizes her. He throws his arms around her, and they're kissing and hugging, and the laureate is pumping gas, watching all this very seriously. Click, the tank is full. And he calls out, "Darling, it's time to go." So they get in the car, and he's driving, and now his wife is sitting beside him, and she's very sad. She has a tear in her eye, and the laureate turns to her and says, "What was that all about?" And she turns to him and says, "Dear, I never told you this, but before I met you, I was in love with that man, and we were going to be married." And the laureate, now he's irritated, he loses his temper, he says, "Well, it's a good thing you didn't. After all, you'd be stuck here in the desert, and as you know, I won the Nobel Prize." And she glares at him and says, "Darling, you really don't understand. If I'd married him, he would have won the Nobel Prize." So, it's my wife's favorite story. In the 21st century, this story will be told a little differently because of the emergence of women in science. Melanie Bonhiver, who worked with us at Hopkins, is one of many young women who've entered science. So I dare say this story will be told a little differently in the near future about a Nobel Prize winner and her husband on vacation. So I think we shouldn't be so serious. Science is about people working together. Rarely is it about a genius at work all alone. Very rarely, maybe never. So my story in science is not exceptional. I had a lot of help, a lot of inspiration, and some hardships, some good luck, a lot of hard work. But it really started when I was a child. So those of you who have been to the United States know in the north central part of the country, there's a state called Minnesota. It's the most Arctic and Canadian of the American states, and it was settled and peopled by a lot of Scandinavian immigrants from 125 years ago. And my ancestors were Norwegian farmers who came to Minnesota. And my parents were both the children and grandchildren of Norwegian farmers. And this sort of pervaded our family because there were some characteristics. First off, I think there was a great, there's a great appreciation for education, but the opportunities weren't always there. My mother never had an opportunity to go beyond high school. And despite a very humble upbringing, she always appreciated the opportunity to read. And when we were small children, she always read to us all of the good books, the children's Bible, but also the books like Robert Louis Stevenson, Jules Verne, the Robinson Crusoe stories, the Laura Ingalls Wilder stories. Now, Dad's family was a little more prosperous, and he was able to go to the University of Minnesota, a large state university, where he studied chemistry, and he became a chemistry professor at a small college. A college is a university without a graduate program. And despite their differences in educational background, they fell in love and they got married and moved to a small town where Dad became the chairman of chemistry. And my mother then stayed at home and had babies, and I was the second of six children. And the backgrounds were such that we were always encouraged, even though it wasn't always easy. Mother would read to us at night, but of my brothers and sisters, one brother is significantly handicapped. He's mentally retarded and has suffered always because of this. But he was always included. We never thought this was a hardship for our family. This was just Paul, and this is what we expected from Paul, and we loved him. I have a sister who's emotionally disabled, and Ruth also, many problems, but we were part of the same family. We never considered ourselves special or particularly fortunate or unfortunate. Now, Dad, who was a scientist, would share his interest in science and math by bringing us to his laboratory. We're small children, we got to put our hands on actual chemistry test tubes and do little experiments. These weren't really experiments. They were rigged. A drop of a colorless solution containing acid into another solution, which is colorless with an indicator dye, turns brilliantly pink instantly. And when you're 6 or 7 years old, that's amazing. And so really the physical reality of science, not the textbook descriptions, but the physical reality of science at an early age captures your attention like nothing else. And when I was in third grade in school, 7 years old, our teacher had asked us to draw a picture of what we would do when we grew up, what we wanted to do. And of course, my dad was my hero, the chairman of chemistry. I drew a picture of a chemist with test tubes because that's what I wanted to be. Although I couldn't help noticing that sitting beside me, my friend Jay Peterson, whose father was a professor of biology, Jay was carefully drawing the picture of a burglar. I always wondered what became of Jay. Did he become a lawyer or a congressman? No, actually, he became a biologist like his father. So this was a very special world, and science was all around us. Now, 50 years ago this past October, a special occurrence changed our lives in a way that we didn't appreciate at first. It was a Sunday afternoon. Dad came to get my brothers and me to come home for Sunday dinner. And while we were walking along, he talked about something on the radio. The Soviet Union, which was our adversary, the Soviet Union had launched a satellite named Sputnik. And the Americans were caught totally by surprise. In this race for dominance in space, our adversaries had defeated us. They were the first into space. And we talked about this and didn't think much more about it. But it really did change our lives because the American public, without any debate about taxes, embraced the need for improvements of education, particularly science, mathematical, but all education, with a massive outpouring of support. And of course, there became a lot of public interest in science. This was the time television had been introduced into Minnesota, and the favorite television show for all children was on Sunday evening, is the Disney Show. And the Disney Show reflected the Disneyland, which had four kingdoms, Fantasyland, Adventureland, a Frontierland, and Tomorrowland. And so every fourth week, this television show would be about science and technology. And so the children of America would watch Wernher von Braun talking about jet propulsion and rocketry. One week, Glenn Seaborg, the great Berkeley chemist, in a very simple demonstration, exhibited the potential of the chemical chain reaction. And it's a very interesting demonstration. This great Berkeley chemist appears before the set with a mousetrap and a ping pong ball. With a pencil, he sets it up, the ball flies, and the camera turns to the floor of a large room entirely covered with mousetraps, each with a ping pong ball. And he tosses in a ping pong ball, and within seconds, 2, 4, 8, the room is a cloud of flying mousetraps and ping pong balls. The demonstration is very simple, but unforgettable. And of course, science was well known by the public. In the 1950s, every American knew the name of Jonas Salk, the polio vaccine pioneer. So it wasn't obscure. Science was nothing to apologize for. And because of the availability of public funds, my dad wrote a National Science Foundation fellowship application to do a sabbatical at the University of California in Berkeley. Now, our village of Northfield, Minnesota, where he lived, was a small farming community with two colleges. And it's oftentimes kind of referred to as the Lake Wobegon. This is a quiet life. And so we packed up our old station wagon and drove out to California. I think we must have looked like some kind of Norwegian equivalent to the Beverly Hillbillies as we drove across the country. And we spent a year at Berkeley, and it was really very interesting. It was unforgettable, because here was an entire city and a major university where science was the principal focus. And while I was only 9 and 10 years old at that time, we got to meet some of these great scientists at Berkeley. And they were very impressionable. Now, one of Dad's friends would come up from Pasadena. His name was Linus Pauling, a professor at Caltech. And we got to know him. He stayed at our house. A big, very garrulous person who was very important in American science, both for the science in the laboratory and for bringing science to the public. Many of you may have known the name of Linus Pauling, because he's the only person ever to receive two Nobel Prizes unshared. In 1954, he received the Nobel Prize for elucidation of the chemical bond and the structures of molecules. And in 1963, he received the Nobel Prize for Peace, because in his scientific lecture opportunities, he would always take an opportunity to speak to the public and share with the public the need for understanding the dangers of nuclear testing in the atmosphere and the dangers of thermonuclear war. And these efforts got a lot of interest and spread around the world, which got him the Nobel Prize in Peace. And he used every opportunity, I repeat, every opportunity to bring science to the public, including a very special event at the White House. Now, President Eisenhower had named the first science advisor to the White House, James Killian, the president of MIT, who advised the government on nuclear arms and nuclear arms dangers. Kennedy appointed Jerome Wiesner, also from MIT, to the White House, and decided he would take science a step further, first announcing that the plan to put a man on the moon and return him safely within the decade, and also by sponsoring a series of dinners at the White House. The first was an invitation to all American science Nobel laureates for a special dinner, and Pauling, invited to this, used the afternoon before that to lead a protest, holding a sign above his head. So the afternoon before the event, he led a protest which was on all the national news, and his sign said, "Mr. President, we have no right to test." 6 o'clock, straightened his tie, and with his wife went into the White House, where they waited in line until they met President Kennedy. Now, this was on all the news, and President Kennedy, who had a great sense of humor, smiled when he met Professor Pauling, said, "It's a pleasure to meet you. I understand you've been around here earlier today." And by the end of the evening, Pauling was dancing with Jacqueline Kennedy, but President Kennedy signed the Limited Test Ban Treaty. This forbade the testing of nuclear arms in the atmosphere. And then, of course, this prevented the release of radiation into the atmosphere and may have changed the course of history. We don't know, but I think it's an example of an important scientist doing something very, very public and something at an early age I became aware of. Now, lest you think I was a science advocate my entire life, I remind you that all of us have passed through a time in our lives known as adolescence. And during adolescence, we often have interests that are far from what our parents would like us to have interest in. And it was really the goodwill and the careful education of our teachers that kept a lot of us on track. And I'll never forget their gentle guidance and the positive influence. And in particular, there was a teacher I had at the age of 11, Mr. Hughes, who really made science more fun than I had ever realized. And we did experiments in class. There was a nutritional experiment where lab rats, one rat is fed rat chow, the other rat is fed junk food, and you can imagine the outcome. He also played for us his favorite collection of records. These were the songs of a Harvard mathematician named Thomas Lehrer. Tom Lehrer, well, a professor of some note, was very famous for his songs, which were social commentaries. He had one about the civil rights, another one about National Brotherhood, and another one about science, about chemistry, that we would listen to repeatedly in school. And maybe some of you know this song, the Song of the Chemical Elements. Anybody know it? If you do, you're welcome to come down. So I am not a professional singer, and you'll know that in a moment. Now, I decided some years ago I would try to learn some chemistry so that I could share this. So the song, if I remember it, it's you may vaguely recognize the tune of the Song of the Modern General from the Pirates of Penzance. There's antimony, arsenic, aluminum, selenium, and hydrogen, and oxygen, and nitrogen, and rhenium, and nickel, neodymium, neptunium, germanium, and iron, americium, ruthenium, uranium, europium, zirconium, lutetium, vanadium, and lanthanum, and osmium, and astatine, and radium, and gold, and protactinium, and indium, and gallium, and iodine and thorium and thulium and thallium. There's yttrium, ytterbium, actinium, rubidium, and boron, gadolinium, niobium, iridium, and strontium, and silicon, and silver, and samarium, and bismuth, bromine, lithium, beryllium, and barium. There's holmium, and helium, and hafnium, and erbium, and phosphorus, and francium, and fluorine, and terbium, and manganese, and mercury, and molybdenum, and magnesium, dysprosium, and scandium, and cerium, and cesium. There's lead, praseodymium, and platinum, plutonium. Palladium, promethium, potassium, polonium, and tantalum, technetium, titanium, tellurium, and cadmium, and calcium, and chromium, and curium. There's sulfur, californium, and fermium, mendelevium, and also sulfur, californium, and also mendelevium, einsteinium, nobelium. That's the best. And argon, krypton, neon, radon, xenon, zinc, and rhodium. Chlorine, carbon, cobalt, copper, tungsten, tin, and sodium. These are the elements they know about at Harvard. But those who studied chemistry at this fine university in Bordeaux, France, will all agree that others were discovered. So I... So that's 102 elements, except for the three I forgot. There are some others. Does anybody know the others? There are eight others that were discovered after the song was composed. Well, anyway, the importance is not can we recite the chemical elements, but chemistry is all around us. And knowing a little bit about chemistry could be actually very useful. And so as my adolescence pursued, I was even less involved in science. I got the dutiful distinction of leaving high school early to attend night school. I won't go into that. But I matriculated at a small college where Dad taught in Minnesota. After St. Olaf's, he taught at Augsburg College, which is a very modest school. Most of the students are from very, very modest families, working class families. They had part-time jobs. But we had excellent instruction in the sciences. And I decided, as an undergraduate college student, that I really wanted to do something useful with my life. And decided to pursue a career in medicine. And Dad, as a chemistry professor, had many of his students go into medicine. In our community, in the Norwegian Lutheran Church, there was a strong medical missionary movement. This was not evangelical missionary. This was doctors and nurses who would go to Africa and in the poorest countries in Asia to practice medicine. And I decided that was really what I wanted to pursue. And I did research at the University of Minnesota in preparation for medical school. And applied to medical schools. Now, in the United States, the system is a little different. You do your undergraduate first, and then you apply to medical school. So applicants to the medical schools are about 21 or 22 years old. And the schools in the United States are mixed. There are state schools, like University of Bordeaux is a state school, but then they have private universities as well. Harvard, for example, is a private university. And the applications are more favorable in your state school because the government is there so that endows them to produce doctors for the area. Now, the University of Minnesota was our state school, and I applied to this. But one of the requirements to apply to the University of Minnesota is that you take a special test called the Minnesota Multiphasic Personality Inventory. Long title. The MMPI is a psychological test where they really learn a lot about you. There's hundreds of questions, very personal questions, and they ask them again with subtly different wording. And so the application went well, and I had an interview at the University of Minnesota, and I was very convinced I wanted to be a medical doctor, and I'd actually tried very hard at Augsburg College. I became a good student. I was not such a good student in high school. I was more interested in skiing and in girls and other things, which I remained interested in, but I did my studies. So the interview went well, and at the very end, the dean for admissions said, you know, this is a very good interview. Do you have any questions for us? And I thought for a moment I wanted to look very dutiful and attentive. I said, Dean Sullivan, what did you learn about me from this MMPI exam? And he looks in my application, and he looks at me very seriously. He said, these results indicate that you lie more than average. I sat back in my chair, sorry I'd asked. And he looked forward and looked, and said, but these results indicate that you lie less than the average medical student. So I don't know what that means. I was accepted at Johns Hopkins, which is a private university in the East Coast of the U.S., which is well known for a number of things, including their work in third world medicine, tropical diseases, and diseases of the poorest of the poor. And when I received that invitation, I spent the greater part of a year traveling in Asia to see some of these really poor areas up close, and traveled through Southeast Asia and India and hitchhiked across Afghanistan. It was quite an adventure, but it was also eye-opening, because really those are the only times you can really see poor people who are not just poor in terms of cultural advantages, but truly poor. And so I pursued studies as a medical student in a research laboratory working on the problems of cholera. Now, cholera, as most of you may know, is a horrible diarrheal disease that was sweeping through Asia in the 1970s, affecting people of all ages, but particularly seriously affecting small children who could die within hours of this horrible diarrheal disease. And working in a laboratory, we made significant progress on the cholera of the New World, which is not the Vibrio cholera, but E. coli and other bacteria, which release a similar toxin. And I found it really fascinating to make molecular progress on a complicated problem by working with a team of scientists who were very clear-sighted and generous. And we solved the problem of the New World diarrhea. The turistas, as we call them, are due to a toxin, again, very much like cholera toxin. But I made another discovery as a student, and that's that I really admired and enjoyed the presence of other scientists, because they were so culturally rich in their character. They were so involved and passionate. Like Linus Pauling, not just their laboratory science, but things affecting society. And I think maybe it was the people more than the laboratory experience with the test tubes that really caught my fancy and caused me to change my objective. I did become a medical doctor, but I did so with a focus on research. And some of these people in the lab I'd like to just tell you about, as I think those who've not worked in laboratories may suffer from the same kind of restricted view that most Americans have, that scientists are kind of grouchy older men with bad hair and a lot of pins in their pockets, and they talk about their data. And there are people like that, not here in Bordeaux, but there are a few people like, maybe some in the back might be a little. So in this group, my friend who brought me to the lab was a big wave surfer from Hawaii, an outstanding wrestler, but a chemist from Stanford University, Van Bennett. Morley Hollenberg was a Rhodes Scholar from Winnipeg. Ignacio Sandoval, I still talk to Ignacio on frequent occasions, a jet black bearded, intense Spaniard who had been released from Franco's prisons, where he was spending time for being antisocial, and came to America. And he was very opinionated and very leftist in his views. I remember one day the telephone rings and someone jabbering in Spanish. It says, it must be for Ignacio. So Ignacio's talking on the phone. He's getting really excited, really excited. And after about a half an hour, he hangs up. We say, Ignacio, what is it? What's happened? He goes, oh, it's wonderful. It's wonderful. My friends, the students, have assassinated the Prime Minister of Spain. It's like, whoa. We thought, this is really a kind of a level of intensity we don't see amongst our students. And Ignacio worked alongside Gianfredo Pucca, who my wife would tell you is the handsomest man on the planet. Gianfredo from Naples, Italy, is an outstanding scientist, but his career started in an interesting way. He's like a drop-dead handsome, could be a fashion model. He actually was a movie actor. One of the great Italian directors picked him out of a group to play the role of gigolos in movies. And his father, who was a well-known academic neurologist in Naples, said, Gianfredo, you will become a medical doctor, you will become an academic. But he had all these distractions. He was a downhill ski racing champion, and his girlfriend was the heiress to the Vespa fortune. So, you know, they got married, he became a billionaire. What would someone like this want to study in a laboratory? Remember, he's Italian. He decided he would approach the most important scientific project any Italian man could approach, the molecular basis of femininity. And he succeeded. Due a Medline, Pucca, Sica, Nola, and Bresciani, Nature, 1970. Isolation of the estrogen receptor by affinity chromatography. He got so famous when he'd go back to Naples, there'd be a band in an orchestra at the airport greeting him. And of course, when he was in the laboratory, he had a gold cigarette lighter carefully tucked into the top of his skin-tight pants, and it was a constant sachet of secretaries walking down the hallway with unlit cigarettes. And while Gianfredo was, you couldn't really disturb him because he was into his science. Unless you were a woman, he'd be there to light their cigarette. I mean, this made science pretty interesting. One summer, we were joined in the laboratory by a brilliant, truly brilliant young scientist from the American University in Beirut, Naji Sayhoun. Naji was a Palestinian refugee, and he brought with him hatred of Israelis, of American Jews. He'd never met any American Jews. He'd never been to Israel, but this was imprinted because of his background. And he carefully bore this quietly and shared it with just a few of us, and he worked alongside Marvin Siegel, this rotund, happy grandson of a rabbi from Brooklyn, New York, and Naji and Marvin became the best of friends. I mean, where, other than scientific and university opportunities, are there opportunities for people of different cultures, cultures that are at war, to become lifelong friends? So this really changed my course. I decided after clinical training I would return to science. And another wonderful event for me at Hopkins is as a young person, like the Nobel Prize winner in the car, I met my wife Mary, who was working in a laboratory, a virology laboratory, and we fell in love, and we've been together ever since. And she's always supported me in the pursuit of science as opposed to maybe more lucrative clinical career. So we pursued science, and oftentimes the science takes you places you don't expect to go. So I left this third world idea of working on diseases of the poorest of the poor, because we were working on red blood cells, and we discovered the molecular basis of a hemolytic anemia known as hereditary spherocytosis. And it's the most common hemolytic anemia affecting persons of European ancestry. And it's not a severe disease, but we could ascertain at clear molecular level the cause of the disease was a deficiency in one of the structural proteins. And then this led to a series of studies we decided to pursue on the molecular basis of the Rh blood group antigen. Now, Rh is an important clinical entity. My mother, again, never having gone to university, when she got married, found out that she was Rhd positive because of the Rh incompatibility of mothers and their children is a big clinical issue. 85% of us are Rhd positive, 15% are Rhd negative. And while everybody knew about the topic, the molecular basis of Rh was unsolved. So we approached this, we were able to identify the Rh molecule. And actually, we teamed up with a group from Paris, Pierre Cartron and his group at the INSERM unit, and solved the Rh problem. And those studies were really very fascinating for me. Now, these occurred at a time in our lives where a great tragedy caused me to really rethink this whole issue of a life in science. Because Mary and I had two beautiful little daughters at that time who were just gorgeous little kids. And then in her third pregnancy, at the very, very end of pregnancy, a normal pregnancy, there was a premature separation of the placenta, and she hemorrhaged, and our daughter Lydia was born in profound shock, respiratory distress. And it was really difficult. And of course, we didn't all have in the United States, nor do we still have, complete medical coverage for all of our people. So you may think in France you have some problems, but you cover all of your sick people. And we found ourselves in a situation with a daughter who was deathly ill in a hospital with kind of modest medical coverage and huge debt. And if Lydia lived several months and then she died, and we were left still with the debt. And it really, really shook me. I mean, should I give this up, this idea of being a scientist, and do something where I could really take care of my family better? And a great opportunity came when Dr. McCusick from Johns Hopkins offered me an assistant professorship, a tenure-track position, which brings, including amongst the benefits, full healthcare coverage. But Mary supported me all along in pursuing science. And I thought it would be wonderful, if possible, to pursue science that had something to do that caused the death of our daughter. And this is easy to say, but it's hard to do. And in fact, we didn't realize it, but the studies that we were doing on Rh led to the discovery of a second protein, which is a contaminating protein. In fact, it was initially a disappointment, but it was a very curious molecule, which provoked us to look further. And the end of the story is that this is the water channel protein that had been sought by biologists for over a century. It's well known to all of us that plants can grow and draw water up through the roots, and through their stems and through their tissues and are released from the leaves, it's clear to all of us that we can make cerebrospinal fluid, aqueous humor, tears, sweat, saliva. We can concentrate our urine. It was never clear on a molecular basis how some cells can move water so fast. And it was believed that these cells had a molecular plumbing system. And this plumbing system turned out to be the protein we discovered, and which we named aquaporin. And this brought a lot of interest. And of course, we were a small laboratory. We had a few people coming through, but we didn't have a lot of interest and a lot of attention. But things changed. And they changed in many ways for the better. We were able to recruit and attract young people from around the world who were very interested in this water channel protein. And among those, Melanie Bonivier, your faculty member here, came to the laboratory and did some very interesting work on the transport of water through yeast. This is what causes the yeast to survive freezing, which causes them to survive when they're rained upon and there's an osmotic gradient. And in our human tissues, these proteins have a lot of important roles. The aquaporin 1 protein we discovered is important in cerebrospinal fluid release. So our brains are bathed in the spinal fluid that protects them. The aquaporin 2 protein in our kidneys is what causes the final concentration of our urine. Now that may seem pretty mundane, but let me challenge you. The next time you're on an airliner with a full bladder and the seatbelt light is on, think of aquaporin 2. It's pretty important. We generate 180 liters of primary filtrate every day, but we concentrate it down to about 1 liter of final urine. And when this goes awry, there are children with nephrogenic diabetes insipidus who can't concentrate their urine, and they would become brain damaged because of the brain, because of the osmotic release and the dehydration they would suffer. Another protein, aquaporin 3, which we call an aquaglyceroporin because it's permeated by water and glycerol, is present in our skin. Now, I've been receiving a lot of invitations to universities, but it was 3 summers ago I got an invitation by an agency known as Christian Dior. I mean, perhaps you've heard of Christian Dior. They're in Paris. And I gave my lecture, and it was kind of interesting. It was these very tall, gorgeous women with bottles of champagne. I guess Christian Dior is part of this conglomerate with Moët Hennessy and I have no financial interest in Christian Dior. I should tell you first off, I would love to have financial interest, but none was offered. But they have a product which you can buy if you have 50 euros to spare called Hydraction Therapy. It's a skin cream. And of course, the advertisement, I should show you this. On the back of Elle, you know, this beauty magazine, Elle shows this gorgeous blonde model with coming from a swimming pool and advertising this skin cream. And their scientists do have evidence that there's a natural product that in this cream leads to some increase in the expression of aquaglyceroporin 3 in skin. But whether it makes you beautiful or not, I whatever. It's not the drug industry. I showed this magazine advertisement to my mother. She smiled. She says, "Peter, you're finally doing something useful." Aquaporin 4, present in a number of tissues, including brain. We had a conversation this afternoon with some of your colleagues here who are working on multiple sclerosis. And a variant of multiple sclerosis affecting the optic nerve is due to antibodies to the aquaporin 4. And of course, the aquaporin 4 is the protein that causes the brain edema. And the brain edema is a consequence of any injury to brain leading to permanent brain damage. And of course, this is what killed our daughter. And we don't have practical advances that could prevent these problems in the future, but we're on the way. Aquaporin 5 is in skin. It allows us to release sweat when we're thermally stressed, in salivary glands when we're eating and we release saliva, tears. Aquaporin 7, present in fat, it allows the glycerol release when we're fasted or starved. Aquaporin 9 in liver causes the glycerol to be turned back into sugar, glucose, so we can maintain our blood sugar during starvation. And it's also permeated by arsenite. Surprising, arsenite. And it turns out that the aquaporin 9 is a major benefit because during arsenic toxicity, releasing arsenic is a matter of life or death. And those of you who might follow these things are probably aware that we're having now in the world a major epidemic in Bangladesh and East India of arsenic poisoning. The surface water, which is contaminated with Vibrio cholera, cannot be drunk. consumed. If you drink it, you'll develop the diarrheal disease. So the local governments, with very limited resources, these are very poor people, put in tube wells so they can pump the groundwater. But in many cases, the groundwater is severely poisoned with arsenic. So our work leads to an explanation for this. Of course, the prevention is the provision of pure drinking water, which is a basic human right. So I think you get the idea. There was a lot of interest in the aquaporins and a lot of invitations, including every year or so an invitation to Stockholm or some university in Sweden to speak, which I guess I should have known was a clue. It was about 7 or 8 years ago I was invited to lecture, give the Ulf von Euler lecture, named lecture at the Karolinska in Stockholm. And Karolinska is the medical school that awards the Nobel Prize in medicine. And so I flew all night in the economy minus section of the airplane to save some money. And I arrived in the morning at the airport in Stockholm, Arlanda Airport, behind the business class. They get out first, of course, and they all have coats and ties and briefcases. And I noticed the pass control officer asking individually the purpose of your visit to Sweden. And the businessman, would each say business, he would stamp the passport, next business stamp. Finally it came to me, and I was sort of disheveled in old clothes. He said, What is the purpose of your visit to Sweden? And he stared right at me. And I said, well, I'm here to give the Ulf von Euler lecture at the Karolinska Institute. And he looked at me, said, are you nervous? And I said, why, yes, I am a little nervous. And he said, well, you should be. So I don't know if his brother was on the Nobel Committee or something. But it did occur to me that there seemed to be some interest. And in October, 5 years ago, the phone rings early in the morning. And every scientist has a little daydream now and then about the Nobel Committee might call. But it actually was the Nobel Committee on the line saying, this at 5:30 in the morning, informing me that I would share the Nobel Prize in chemistry. Now, in high school, I was a terrible chemistry student. I'm listening to the Nobel Committee, I was thinking, is this where I tell them that I got a D in chemistry? I thought I would just say thank you. And I did, and ran for the shower. And my wife, Mary, who's much cleverer than I am, ran for her cell phone to call my mother. Dad had died 8 years before. And a mother, very calm, very tranquil, Scandinavian farm girl from South Dakota. When my wife called her to tell her I would share the Nobel Prize, she thought for a moment. She said, well, Mary, tell Peter not to let this go to his head. You know, that's good advice. What she meant is there are more important things in life than winning prizes. And doing something useful is much more important than winning a prize. Of course, when I got to the laboratory, the young people were already celebrating. It had gone to their heads. They'd consumed several bottles of champagne already by 10 in the morning. And then the most amazing thing happened. The university president came over to see me. You know, I had no idea we were such close personal friends. It was amazing. And I went to the office, and the voicemail was jammed with requests for interviews for the New York Times and the television. And then there was a very enthusiastic voice, one of our colleagues from Norway. And I'll never forget the voice. He said, Peter, we've just heard the news. It's unbelievable. And there was a pause. And then the voice came back, and I said, no, it's believable. You know. And as I drove home that evening, I saw on the marquee in front of the cut-rate liquor store, instead of announcing the price of Heineken beer, it says, congrats, Dr. Agri. I realized, you know, I'd sort of become a public figure. And the press was interesting because what they wanted to know was, how will you spend the money? Because there's a considerable amount of money. And I told them this was during the persecution of the American scientist Thomas Butler, who I knew earlier in my career, a wonderful scientist who had done some of the infectious disease research with us on cholera, who is being charged in Texas with a bioterror infringement. Basically, he lost some samples from his lab. And so I said we will support the legal defense of Thomas Butler. And it's very interesting, because in that instant, I was reassigned the role of activist. I mean, I'm no activist, but I was viewed as an activist. It was seen as an activist statement in support of a scientist. And in fact, Butler was convicted of nothing related to bioterror, some administrative problems, and he was sent to prison for 2 years, which I thought was a harsh sentence for a minor administrative mistake. Anyway, life does change. As I tell the reporters, our dog doesn't love me any more than before, And fortunately, my family still loves me. But there are opportunities now to use the bully pulpit of the Nobel to talk to the public, to speak to our scientific and non-scientific citizenry about the issues that we're concerned with. And of course, I think the emergence of science is something that could be very good, almost universally is good. On rare occasions, some governments use it for bad purposes. Some individuals might use it for a bad purpose, but this is extremely rare. And I think this is a message that I'm trying to share. First off, with the young people, that your roles in science are unpredictable. They won't be easy. You won't get rich, but you may make a discovery that will change the course of science for everybody. It's a beautiful career. It's a great career, and it can be a really fun career. And yes, every time you go camping or you go on vacation, your vacation will be in a tent. But we had our best times camping with the kids. It was great fun. Secondly, I think it's important that the public understand something to do with science. And I could obviously sense some joy here in France, as we have in the United States, with the election of our new president, who has stated that he will restore science to its proper place, to use science to solve the problems of humanity. It's something that we can all look forward to, but it won't be easy. It'll take a lot of hard work, it'll take funding, and it'll take support for young scientists like yourselves. But rest assured, young scientists, those of us who have reached a certain age are working hard to make sure that the resources will be here. In October, I was a member of a group that evaluated a scientific body in Paris, and we had a meeting with President Sarkozy. And he really wanted to know what we felt was important for science in France. And I told him face to face, I felt the most important thing he could do would be to make sure the young French scientists are supported, because the young scientists are your most precious commodity. And to make the point clear, I said, if you don't support them, we'll keep them all in America. And he goes, whoa, that's a bad idea. So I think the support for science in France should come to another level. And of course, we have much to celebrate with the discovery of HIV receiving the Nobel Prize a few months back. So anyway, that's sort of my story. I'm now spending some of our time working on malaria. Again, a problem of the third world. It's related to the problem in red blood cells. So it's not a midlife crisis. This is something I always wanted to do. I hope some of you young scientists here will join the fight against malaria, because that's one of the major killers. Malaria, HIV, drug-resistant TB kills a lot of children in the poorest of the poor countries. And it involves travel to places like our field station in Zambia, which I always find just very, very heartwarming and wonderful. This is not a sacrifice. I think it's about the most enjoyable thing I can imagine. So with that, I'd like to close, and I'd like to share with you some lines of a song composed by a fellow Minnesotan, a man who regard as the poet laureate of my generation. His name is Bob Dylan. And this is directed to the young people. And the first line of Forever Young goes, may God bless and keep you always. May your wishes all come true. May you always do for others and let others do for you. May you build a ladder to the stars and climb on every rung. May you stay forever young. Thank you.
That's a very long path that you have passed until today, and I hope that this is not the end. What have been the most often met mistakes, and what lessons have you extracted from these mistakes, and what advice could you give to the students, especially in terms of general science? We are not very much proficient in chemical terms in such natural science, but we are mostly of social science. And what advice could you give us for the future scientists of social science in order to avoid evident and latent mistakes? Thank you very much.
Sure. Well, thank you for your question. So the social scientists, of course, are scientists, but they don't deal in test tubes. They're involved in social groups and important issues in terms of education and the other. So I regard the social scientists as our true colleagues. But the greater group of non-scientists, I challenge to take some science courses and reward your teachers in the schools who teach science, because there are fewer and fewer young people with scientific background going into teaching. Because I think it's important for all members of society, elected officials, citizens at all levels, to have some understanding of science. I mean, bacterial drug resistance is not magic. It's actually evolution. It's not threatening to understand this, and it's important to have some idea. Same thing, the issues of global warming. Now, we're finally seeing some evidence that our political figures are taking it seriously by looking at the studies, which are overwhelmingly in support that, yes, global warming is occurring. So I think for society is, take President Obama's advice seriously. Let's restore science to its proper place in the United States, in France, and all over the world. Now, for the young people, the young Melanie Bon Hivers and the Derek Robinsons, who actually want to be scientists, I think I have some different challenges. First off is be patient. It's a long road. There's no quick path to success and recognition. You may have to leave your comfort zone. And, you know, this may be difficult. You're comfortable in an area. Your parents live nearby. The social pressures are stay at home. But both Melanie from France and Derek from England left their homes and all their friends to come to the United States, where they worked for very modest wages. They worked very hard and made brilliant discoveries, and they discovered each other. I mean, they have a beautiful little boy who may be the Barack Obama of France. You just never know where science will lead you. But you can't rush it. The rewards are rewards of the intellect and the feeling you have in your heart that you know you've left something behind which can help others, but maybe not immediately. The great French scientist Louis Pasteur discovered a process that we all know of as pasteurization, which is used commonly. But in his day, it wasn't clear the potential for that. So I think take a long view. Don't be in a rush. Be prepared for some severe challenges, but knowing that the rewards will be the rewards that you look back when you're an old person and know that this was the right career.
I was wondering, you talked a lot about kind of meandering in science a little bit, like you started somewhere, then went somewhere else. Not that that's true, and you ended up producing a wonderful discovery. How do you put together the idea of starting off with a goal, and also being open to where your research actually does take you? Is it the research that should show you where to go, or should you try and direct the research?
This is a very important issue. And thank you, coming all the way from California. So the line I flubbed was, there's sulfur californium and fermium berkelium. You have to have a purpose to come to the lab. This is not some taxpayer-supported random walk through anything. There has to be a hypothesis in order to get up in the morning to come to the lab to do something. But the hypothesis ends when the experiment has results. And sometimes the hypothesis is correct, your idea is correct, and it's maybe then it's predictable. Maybe it's not exciting. But it could be useful. On the other hand, some of the results don't fit. And the challenge is, do we disregard this information that doesn't fit our hypothesis? And in our case, this contaminating molecule in the RH preparations was kind of a nuisance. It was basically the dirt, but it had some interesting lessons. And that's where it's hard to tell people, well, follow every artifact, because that's clearly not going to be productive. But sometimes look again. Look a second time. Try a couple of simple experiments. And maybe you do it on Friday afternoon or Saturday when you're not distracted from your major goal. And keep your eyes open. Because people say, well, you know, Professor Agri, you say it's important to be lucky. What is luck? I think luck is a matter of being in the right place at the right time with your eyes wide open. That's Pasteur's view. Luck favors the prepared mind. And when you find something that's exciting, you should go for it. That doesn't mean abandon everything you're supposed to be doing. Your mentor in the laboratories will have a hard time if you just randomly jump from project to project. But there's a time where you should go for it. And it's hard for me to tell you when that project emerges. But I dare say it may come when you least expect it. Thanks.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you.